Tired of standing in line at the chain drugstore for your monthly medications? Enter Fill, the smarter prescription refill service. Your monthly medications are filled by top-rated, locally owned pharmacies and delivered to your door for free. They troubleshoot insurance and chase after doctors so you don't have to. Go to fill.us/club to get $20 off your first prescription. That's Fill, like the person, .us/club.
Welcome to the Crack Movie Club. I'm Abe Epperson.
I'm Tom Ryman.
And we're the so-called cracked experts on pop culture films from the last 3 to 4 decades. We're here to point out some things you may or may not know about your favorite classics and drop observations that might ruin the movie for you, or maybe not. Well, it's up to you, really.
It'll ruin-hance the movie for you.
Yeah, ruin-hance.
That's what we're hoping for.
So for the next 45 to 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting the following film, Jaws, from 1975, directed by Steven Spielberg.
All right, yeah. I think this is our last episode of Spielberg Month.
Yep, so. Last episode. We'll be moving on to another director, which we'll reveal at the end of this podcast. Along with us is our guest, Brandy Posey.
Hello.
Who is the co-host and co-creator of Lady to Lady and Picture This. So we want to start off by asking you a question.
Yeah.
When was the first time you watched Jaws?
Last night.
Really?
Really?
You hadn't seen it before last night?
I had never seen it before last night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
This is a feast.
Oh, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah. What was your, like, pop culture awareness of Jaws? Like, how did you see it before you walked into the film?
It was interesting to know, like, things that were references to Jaws before actually knowing what the thing that they were referencing.
Right.
Like, I was like, oh, this is what Bad Hat Harry's from. Okay.
Right,
okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I always knew that was from something. I didn't know what it was from.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I saw Child's Play 2 and it ruined me for horror movies forever.
And you started with Child's Play 2.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It was a sleepover.
Just right out the gate.
It turns out the first one, not necessary.
Yeah. Nope.
That's fair.
Had not no questions going in the second one.
No, not at all. You just had demonic doll. Like, just, yeah, don't, yeah.
The premise explains itself.
Yeah, classic story.
But it ruined me on horror movies for a long time. So, and then I just, like, never got around to watching Jaws because it's like, you know, I just never did. And then I was like, oh, here's a reason to watch it. So
Did you know, like, the theme? I mean, everybody knows.
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
It, everybody knows the
I was surprised at how little it's actually used in the movie.
Right.
Is what I assumed. I assumed it was a worse movie than it was.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Oh, really?
Like, I thought maybe it would have aged more poorly than it actually did. Mm. But it was fun.
Yeah,
cool.
I was pleasantly surprised.
Spielberg's legit. That's what.
Yeah. I can't remember.
Movies don't age.
No, they
I can't remember the theme exactly. Does it go like?
Yeah, that's it.
It's a da 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 da.
There it is.
Yeah, that's the
that's
one.
It.
Ah, good.
It really strikes terror into.
So before we begin into like the meat of it, please give a synopsis of the film as best as you can remember it from last night.
Yeah, just a brief synopsis of how would you describe this film in a sentence or two?
Okay. The town for Murder, She Wrote has a drinking problem.
You're killing her.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. That's basically
the metaphor.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Destroyed. Also a shark, but mostly.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a drunk shark as well.
Drunk shark.
He's also got
too.
A problem.
Yeah. He's just on a bender. Completely on a bender.
Is the shark Angela Lansbury?
Yes.
He's there trying to solve a mystery.
Flopping around in the seat.
Right.
This it's whole
like,
time.
It's just like flopping his fins at a typewriter.
When we upgraded from the TV budget to the movie budget, hey, I know number one change we're going to make. Angela Lansbury, she's a shark.
The George Lucas said, they're like, we always envisioned Angela Lansbury being a gigantic shark.
Yeah.
But we just never had the budget to pull
Steven,
it off.
Steven, I got an idea.
We go back to old episodes of Murder, She Wrote and just
insert
put a
the shark.
Shark
like in E.T., they replace all the guns with walkie-talkies.
Yeah.
All sharks are in. all, globally.
Still prehistoric like
dinosaur.
Though, just very dignified looking shark.
That's fucking hilarious.
Well,
I think that's a good sum up of the film. On this show, we like to double down on that and compare your do terrible log lines of the film.
Yeah. Same we like to call terrible log lines, which you've already started.
You started. It's,
I mean, that's the winner. But.
But, I mean, this is Jaws. Everyone knows Jaws.
Everyone knows the story
if
of Jaws.
You can't get people, if you want a synopsis, just go to IMDb right now.
Yeah.
It's going to be fine. All right.
Yeah, there's a shark and it kills people.
A shark and it eats people. And people are upset about it.
Yeah. And at the end, someone kills the shark.
The shark, yeah. And then victory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Classic tale. All right, let's do some terrible log lines.
Okay.
Three men get drunk and sink a boat.
Just love that there's no shark involved.
No, sharks and it's incidental.
Classic boy meets shark, shark eats boy, shark eats scuba tank tail.
Aw, we all know how that plays out.
That old trope.
Sure.
Capitalism fed my son to a shark.
Capitalism. It's true, it's to life for. Oh, man.
A sea monster ruins summer for wealthy business owners.
The ultimate deep sea dick measure.
Oh.
That's true.
The shark is just a gigantic dick.
Does I?
The mayor of a small town loses his re-election bid.
Oof.
Yeah. Oof. For sure.
It makes me really sad about that mayor because he's just like left
he's
with this mess.
With his little suit with anchors on him.
Mr. Holland's porpoise.
Oh. That's bad. Oh, that's terrible.
Really, this is awful.
I love it.
Oh, man.
A serial killer is finally exposed after leaving teeth at the scene of a crime.
Okay. You got one more, Brandon?
Yeah, I got my last one. Make America great white again.
Oh.
Ooh. Well, that's just...
Let's make some bumper stickers with the Jaws outline, you know? And she's got a little tuft of hair.
I feel like that was like the first draft of Trump's actual slogan.
Absolutely.
Because he kind of thinks he's a shark, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure. He just keeps moving. He keeps moving. He never stops swimming.
Always winning. Yeah. Always,
always winning.
Boats.
Please, dark Mr. President, eyes. Stop winning so much. Stop eating so much of our tourists.
You're killing the 4th of July.
Oh, man. Oh, that was pretty good.
Yeah. I enjoyed that thoroughly. Good job.
All right. Well, now we're going to, now that you know the plot of the movie, we're going to dive into kind of the making of the movie, sort of from a pre-production to post-production standpoint in a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending.
Yeah, let's talk about pre-production. I had a thing about scripting that I really liked, which Spielberg and the producers wanted to keep Act 3 from the book because it originally was a book before it was a movie. But they didn't care about Act 1 or 2 of the book. They were like, yeah, whatever. And so Spielberg told Gottlieb, who's the writer, to
Carl Gottlieb, yeah.
Yeah, to rewrite Act 1 and 2. Basically, so Spielberg could just film a horror, like, shark movie? Shark chase movie? Like, that's all he really wanted out of it.
Yeah. Shark heist.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man, I want to see that movie.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, no, with Jaws is an interesting thing because, like Abe just mentioned, it was based on a book, but it was one of those cases, and interestingly, Jurassic Park was the same, where the movie rights to the book were sold before the book was published.
Oh, so, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, Peter Benchley, I don't even think, had even finished writing the book before the movie rights were sold to Universal, so they scooped it up and we're going to make this movie. And then the book's not very good. So
I've heard the writer's a psycho is what I've heard. That he's
actually,
yeah, there's like stuff in it that is like insane.
It's just very boring. It's it's kind of sleazy too. It's like kind of like a sleazy, there's mob elements. Chief Brody's wife is cheating on him with Hooper.
Oh, that's
the Richard
thing
Dreyfuss character.
That's what I heard. And it's like,
yeah,
that's
and it's just
so
like,
unnecessary.
Right. It's just
a killer shark.
Yeah. It's like, you don't need all this B story to an adventure book about a killer shark. Like, that should be enough, right?
Yeah.
To like carry your story.
Is it like the shark? The reason that Brody goes after the shark is because the shark is like, I heard that you're one of the Hooper.
When he jumps up on the boat at the end, that's what he's like, I gotta tell you something.
Yeah. Or all this scene.
I'm your friend. I can't watch this keep happening to you.
Yeah, I really miss those scenes in like Die Hard where they just cut to like what's going down in like the economics of New York. You know, just like some firm go like, we gotta make more money. Just like makes no sense to put it there. Why is it there?
Yeah.
So that was like one of the first things that the producers for the movie were Richard Zanuck and David Brown, and then Sid Sheinberg, who was the president of Universal at the time. And actually, his wife plays Chief Brody's wife in the movie.
Oh, she's fun.
Yeah, she's great.
Oh, she's great.
But like their first note was like when they bought the book, they're like, okay, we got to cut all this B-plot bullshit out. Like, this movie about hunting a shark. Let's just make it about hunting the shark.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely correct. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
like,
for
the
sure correct.
Movie is 10 times, I mean, more so, but it's like far and away, like much better than the book. Like the books, don't even waste your time with it.
Have we said that you were wearing a Jaws shirt right now?
No, I am wearing a Jaws shirt, kind of accidentally. It's just, it's
I don't
one
believe
of like,
you.
It's one
I
of like
don't.
Three that I own. I legit forgot that. I knew we were recording today, but I just had like separated what movie we were going to be talking about in my mind.
I actually totally, knowing this guy, I totally buy it. Like, he's always wearing a pop culture shirt that totally means a lot to him, you know? Like,
gotcha. It's very significant.
Yeah, very significant.
Very significant to me.
Another thing I want to mention about, like, the scripting or just, like the painting a picture of where we were before is Spielberg made two films before this.
Right.
And there were love songs to, like, past films.
Okay.
So, like, Duel was essentially his love song to North by Northwest.
Duel was his first film, which actually had... you go ahead and...
Well, I just wanted to say the second film was Sugarland Express, which is a road movie. It's like a Scufflaw. It's Goldie Hawn, and I forget the other character. But they're being chased by cops. It's like Thelma and Louise, but like a love story.
Cool.
But everything about it is Looney Tunes, specifically Roadrunner. And so he's basically just going down the line saying, like, here's what developed me.
Mm-hmm.
And Spielberg had some problems finding quotes for this movie. In a lot of ways, he couldn't really prepare for the horrible production conditions that were plaguing this entire production.
Yeah.
Therefore, this is like the first, if not only, Spielberg film that does not feel like Spielberg. And that's kind of why. They also didn't have a solid script before they like started filming.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, so when they were putting this movie into production, there was an actor strike that was about to happen.
Oh, okay.
Which meant that they had to, any movie that was not already in production couldn't start.
Right.
Once the strike hit. So they had to put Jaws in production as soon as possible. So they didn't really have a script. The way they got around that was they hired the screenwriter, Carl Gottlieb, as an actor in the movie. He's in the movie. He plays the reporter, Meadows, guy with the mustache.
Yeah, yeah.
So he would be on set as an actor, but then also he would be able to do rewrites and punch-ups. And you can see in behind-the-scenes footage, like in between shots, like he and Spielberg get together and like write the dialogue for the next scene.
Right.
Wow, cool.
Wasn't it a writer strike, not an actor strike?
I can't remember.
I think it makes more sense because they have to hire him as an actor.
As an actor. Okay,
because they can't hire
strike.
Him as a writer. Because that would make him a scab.
Somebody had told me that the Quint, his whole monologue about the USS Indianapolis, he wrote that. The actor
did,
wrote
that.
That makes sense for a writer strike, too.
Yeah, definitely.
And we'll talk more
about... We'll definitely get into that.
In fact, let's do that right now. Let's talk about casting. You know a lot about that. Tell me about Hooper casting.
Okay, Hooper casting. They were talking to, Jeff Bridges.
Wasn't also John Voight?
John Voight.
Those are two very different movies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Very different movie. I almost wish we could just see that movie.
Why did they land on Dreyfus?
Because Spielberg was friends with Lucas at this point.
Yeah.
More in like a protege. Because we're still in the, Lucas is still like a more, even though Star Wars hasn't come out, he's still like,
He's
friends with Spielberg. He's got like Coppola's backing him at this point.
Okay.
So Lucas is kind of like being pushed as like the new star kid, and Spielberg's kind of like his protege at this point. But he recommended Dreyfus because Dreyfus was in American Graffiti, and Dreyfus initially said no because he read the script and was like, "Yeah, this seems like it's going to be a real fun movie. It seems like it's going to be a pain in the ass to film it. I don't want to be in it."
Yeah.
Totally right.
And so he passed, but then he went and saw a screening of a movie he had just done where he was the lead. It's called The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz, and it wound up getting amazing reviews, like rave reviews. But for whatever reason, when Dreyfus saw the screening, he had a terrible experience. Like, he was just, like, mortified by his performance. I don't know if, like, the audience felt that way or if it just, like, the screening went bad. But he, like, panicked seeing the screening of this movie and then went back and was like, "You guys still want me for that movie?" Because, like, he felt like his career was in trouble. So he's like, he jumped onto the movie.
My guess is drugs.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a cocaine screening.
I need some drugs.
No, give me the drugs.
Give me the drugs.
But, yeah, actually, it's an interesting point because Robert Shaw, who's, like, at this point, you know, huge, you know, so he, first off, he's a total alcoholic, but he was also supposed to be the big star of the show. And when Dreyfus started getting all these rave reviews for the film while they were like during production, it caused this like really terrible, like interaction between
Rift
Dreyfus
between
and
them. Yeah.
Screaming matches and stuff like that.
Yeah. And they got to Shaw. Initially they talked to Lee Marvin, who is in, The Dirty Dozen.
Okay.
And a couple other movies.
Hell in the Pacific.
Hell in the Pacific, yeah. It's kind of an older actor, a lot of military-style roles.
Cowboy.
Yeah.
Like pre-Eastwood.
But he passed hard. He was like, I don't have any interest in making this movie. And then they wanted Sterling
Not
Hayden.
Not a fan of the sea.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm done with the sea. I think his quote was something along the lines of, "Nah, I'd rather go fishing than be in this movie about fishing."
Well, I mean, he was on Hell in the Pacific. He obviously was going to pass because he had already made a
water movie.
He just made a big water movie. And he was like, "Nah, man."
Yeah.
Like, "No, it's going to be fine. We're going to like, we got this production lockdown." So, yeah, no.
Yeah.
You don't know what you're getting into.
No. With a giant robot shark? Yeah, man. Okay.
And I kind of want to start to get into the woes of the production, unless you have another point on casting.
Just, they landed on, they wanted Sterling Hayden from Doctor Strangelove. They couldn't get him. And then they landed on Shaw because he had just done The Sting for Universal the year or two before, which is one of the biggest moneymakers of all time at that point. Yeah. So they were like, hey, why don't you use Robert Shaw? So they put him in the movie. And they had this weird thing where they had to keep flying him back and forth to Canada because he wasn't an American citizen.
Oh, okay.
He was a British citizen. So to avoid him getting like crushed by taxes, they had to like fly him to Canada, I think, every week.
Right.
Wow.
So and he was also drunk all the time.
So yeah. While there was an actual shark, there was also a metaphoric shark in the water in terms of Shaw. Like, he had to deal with this monster.
Right.
Who just was like a tumultuous, like, just a tornado through set.
Oh, yeah, there were apparently stories from PAs who worked on the movie where they'd come to pick him up at like 4 or 5 a.m., and he'd greet them with like a bottle of something to like sip on while they're driving over there. And then he gets to makeup. And then when they're in the makeup, they have like a martini shaker prepared for him. So he gets to drink while he's in makeup.
Get my morning
teeny. So he's
just
teeny. Like, yeah. My Don teeny.
Oh,
I mean, for that role though, that's like pretty method.
It works
even
for
if
the
it was
role.
Unintentional like, method. Like it's,
you think he was like, have an actual shark eat me.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually kill me. Please
drag him up on this boat.
Me.
I'll climb into his mouth.
Surprisingly, actually, the shark was also a method actor.
Yeah.
Eight
shark,
people.
Yeah. Insisted on being called Jaws throughout the entire.
Just like
when I'm on set, I'm Jaws.
Yeah. I remember when I was young, I totally thought that the name of the shark in Jaws was Jaws.
Sure, why not?
Someone just like, where's Jaws?
Jaws, not again.
You got my foot. So let's talk about this production. We keep you know, winding around about it. It was about 150.
We keep circling in on
it. It took about 150 days.
Yeah.
Some days for
shooting days, just for shooting.
Yeah, physical
Whoa,
production.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's like insane, especially at this time for reasons that we mentioned that the studio was like not a big fan of spending money on this picture.
Yeah.
And there's
Real quick, was Spielberg assigned to it or this was something he really wanted to make?
He wanted it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
What
got
happened,
it,
he saw this, he saw the book in Zanuck and Brown, the producer's office. They had just done Sugarland Express with them. Mm-hmm. He read it. He immediately responded to it because it felt a lot to him like Duel, his first movie. And Duel, if you haven't seen it, is about a traveling salesman who is getting just relentlessly chased by this tractor trailer, this gigantic truck. And you never see the driver. It's just like this monstrous force.
Got it.
So he's like, oh, this is like Jaws. Because it kind of is. So he wanted to make that. And they were like, hey, the Spielberg kid's really good. Let's give him this movie. But he was still pretty green as a director.
Yeah. I mean, he had done like a Twilight Zone episode. Like he'd
Alfred
been
Hitchcock
around.
Presents.
Yeah, that's it.
And like...
But yeah, the reason that... So one of the first reasons that this was... you know, hell on earth, was they made the sharks out of a material called neoprene, which is great for when you want to mimic, like, the skin of a shark. But it's also water absorbent.
Oh, geez.
So the three shark robots that they had to make the film, and it's, like, left side, right side, and a full model.
And a full body
shark. Could only be in the water for only so long before they would literally be sinking.
Wow.
And they didn't have, and the bummer was, we mentioned the strike, they had to rush this into production. They didn't really have time to adequately test it. They only tested the sharks on land, which seems like a huge, like, oversight, because you're like...
Land shark.
They, at one point, they were probably, what if the shark was just on land? Like, can we just get him a little, like, have him, like, wheel around in a little wheelbarrow?
What if we put him on a skateboard? Yeah. I'm just saying.
Cool sharks.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool sharks.
But it caused huge production delays.
Right, because it would just get waterlogged and sink.
Oh, and geez. David Brown, who's one of the producers, argues that the picture was supposed to be $4 million. It actually turned into something more like $9 million. And he argues that it took three million of those million were sunk literally into the
Sharks.
Just the sharks themselves were $3 million.
Wow.
Which, this is 1975 money.
That's a lot.
Just for
a whole
three
lot
sharks.
Of money.
Yeah. Luckily, none of them sank. I mean,
Can you imagine
they almost
lost
did.
One.
Yeah, completely. If they lost one.
That probably would have ended the movie.
Yeah. I'm done.
You kind of have to treat that. People often forget about shooting on the water, kind of segue into just like the modes of physical production.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier when you're on land. Mm-hmm. But a film crew on a boat, it's not just like film crew actors boat. You got
you know, it's not just cramming one guy with a camera on a boat with all the actors.
They're taking a small fleet of like safety boats, boats with the lights on them, like individual boats for lighting, like 3-point lighting. You need 3 boats.
Yeah.
And they had to have like craft services, probably extra bathrooms and, you know, food and stuff. So you have a bunch of this stuff for as many as 50 film crew and cast. So that's like this is like an army of people every day for 150 days. And everything goes wrong because the ocean isn't like roads, right?
No.
You can't really block the intersection. You can't really block the horizon line.
No.
So any, you know, Tom on a boat just go like, oh, what's going on? And most people, this is shot in Martha's Vineyard, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is kind of fairly public. And anyone with a sailboat can just kind of fly, like,
cruise on through. It's not like,
especially with this huge fleet going on.
Yeah.
If you're a background, you're gonna like, oh, what's that? I'm gonna watch that for like an hour.
What's happening over there?
So they often, like Spielberg once said, like sometimes a good day would be like 25 shots.
I think his quote was five shots.
Good day was five shots.
An average day was 3 shots, and a bad day was 0.
Wow.
And that's why it took 150-odd shooting days. It's, you know, it's, and even if like people crossing the horizon didn't stop, it's not like a car or like a plane. We're just like, hold, okay, shoot. Like it takes like an hour for that thing to cross.
Yeah,
so they have to just sit there and wait.
Oh my gosh.
And then, of course, all these boats, you know, once you get everything situated, get everything set up, you anchor all the boats. By then, everything's drifted like 5 feet.
So
shit. When the sun moves, you know, all of that.
It's a train wreck.
Lots of nightmares. And then Martha's Vineyard itself was kind of a pain in the butt. I think this was the first time they had ever opened themselves up to a Hollywood production because they're like, you know, it's a
hoity-toity little
and they're very
fancy
like,
area.
You know, building restrictions and like you can't, you know, we can't mess up the natural beauty of our place.
Yeah.
So homeowners association, the town.
Right.
Oh, for sure.
the condo association.
Yeah.
You're bringing down our property value.
Yeah. Another reason that this sucked was I want to call out like MVP Bill Butler, director of photography.
This guy,
Billy Butts, my boy. He's the director of photography, and he is just killing it on this film in a way that like few have.
Oh yeah, he invented a new camera housing. Basically,
yeah, it's like
shoot on the water. You know how all the shots are like right on the waterline.
Yeah, yeah.
That was really important to Spielberg because he was like, I want all of it to be a person's perspective if they were in the water. So like when you're swimming,
so it's
like,
terrifying.
Make it scarier. It is scary. So Bill Butler built this special rigging that would keep the camera steady on the water and also keep it waterproof. It's like this box, basically.
It's a box that it was a buoy system to make it afloat, but then also gyroscopic mechanism so that like the footage, when you watch it, you wouldn't vomit.
Yeah.
Because it had
sense.
To be kind of smooth
yeah.
to kind of make it feel like you're treading water.
Or otherwise, it would be like a found footage movie.
Otherwise, because, you know, I don't know if you know about waves, but severe limitation. And at one point it almost sank. They sank a camera. It didn't sink in that thing, but they lost a camera because this is a new technology. So they had to do prototypes, R&D, and then actually test it. And they lost a camera. It didn't have film or anything like that. But when they were testing it, they lost one, which is like not, they're shooting on Panavision. This is not like a small deal.
It's not cheap.
It costs like many thousands of dollars for your production. So there's another reason why. The other cool thing about Bill Butler and to more an extent Spielberg, as we mentioned, like the limited space on these boats. The reason that it's really doesn't feel like a Spielberg film is that Spielberg is well known for like the Spielberg Wonder, or is just the idea of like he constantly is moving. There's like dollies, which is just track that they lay down so that the camera can smoothly like navigate through space. He had to invent blocking to make it more dynamic for the actors because the camera couldn't move. It could only like pan around and look. So he shot a film like a Kurosawa film, which is like the people do the blocking, which is like not Spielberg's bag.
I know, that's so interesting that
style.
It's like one of his most famous movies, and it's the least like a Spielberg movie.
Yeah,
because he can't do anything. He just has to go, okay, just to get this done.
Leave it in one spot. Fine.
So it's like shooting a film like Kevin Smith, where he parks the camera. All right, speak.
It's your third movie. Production sucks. It's not even got your fingerprint on it. Why does he want to make this movie?
I think at that point he was locked into it.
Yeah.
Like
he just didn't know what he's getting into.
Is this movie the first time that like zoom in, pull out shot happens?
Oh,
not the first time.
No, it's famously called the vertigo zoom
from
Hitchcock, from Hitchcock's Vertigo.
Okay,
but
and
Abe can speak to that.
Yeah, I'll speak to it just because our audience may not know. So what she's talking about is that they call it a Zolly shot or a Vertigo shot. And what it's also, you'll notice it if you haven't seen those films, in Goodfellas, in the coffee shop, it's a slower one. More famously or recently, Frodo shot in Fellowship of the Ring when he senses that the Nazgul are coming down the road.
Mm-hmm.
It does this whole thing. And so that effect, think of that effect. Now, what it's really happening there, or the science behind it, is the background and the foreground are either opening up or like disproportionately to, like, that foreground and the background are moving at different things. And that's mainly called parallax. So it's a forced parallax. And the way they do that is they take a dolly. And so, like, let's imagine you move the camera 15 feet forward.
Yeah.
While you're doing that, zoom out. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing is you're changing the focal length of the lens so that you see more and space is either getting compressed or distorted or, you know, depressed, I guess.
Yeah.
Increased. Compressed, I don't know.
Compressed, yeah. It has this really, really
eerie
kind
feeling.
Of weird feeling to it.
And it's kind of cool, but it definitely was like, people had known it, but it hadn't, like, it's hard to accomplish, first off.
Yeah.
But also, like, it was one of the biggest first times, because Vertigo was big, but like audiences weren't thinking about it as much because it's not, I don't know.
Jaws became the biggest movie of all time. So it's like everybody saw it in Jaws.
And it's specifically like they use it for horror a lot, but they also use it for like having a person having a moment of realization.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also, it was a scene on land and that's the only time he gets to move the camera. Yes. Parts of the movie.
We gotta do it. We gotta do it. Come on.
I think like 40% of the movie is on the water.
At least.
The reason they picked Martha's Vineyard is because, normally they wouldn't, because it's the East Coast. The water's dark. It's very choppy. Normally they would pick someplace like down in the Caribbean or something where the waters are calmer. But because a couple of miles out from Martha's Vineyard, there's this sandbar that's about 20 feet below the surface. And their main shark is runs on a car, basically.
Oh.
It's a little shark, and then it's on a gimbal, which is like a crane arm, which is attached to this car, and the car runs along the bottom of the ocean. So the arm can raise and lower, and then the shark on the top of the arm can like be manipulated. And so because the sandbar was so far out, it allowed him to have the boat be out in the ocean where you couldn't see land anywhere, which was important to Spielberg because he wanted to have that feeling of you're out in the middle of the ocean, you're beyond help. Mm-hmm. But it was shallow enough they could run their shark car.
Yeah.
So that's why they picked Martha's Vineyard.
Cool band name.
Yeah. Shark car?
Yeah.
Hey, with shark hair.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And they actually named...
Do you have a question?
How did they get this car out there? Did they just take it? Did they drive it out?
On a boat.
Okay, they put it out and then they dropped it in the water.
Yeah, it's like aquatic car kind
of
deal.
Who's that guy? Who's driving the car?
I don't know.
That's really a remote, hell of a job.
I think remote control.
Oh, okay.
There's a guy.
In my head, there's a guy in a car.
Suit.
Yeah. Some teamster down there.
Yeah.
Is it break time yet?
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah.
Just smoking a cigarette underwater.
Yeah,
underwater.
Exactly.
Underneath his mask.
Furious, he can't check his phone. Oh, it's the 70s.
Another fact about the shark is they named the main shark Bruce. And the reason they did is because Bruce was the name of the notorious lawyer who's in charge of like the production, and he's known
Spielberg's
as a shark
lawyer.
He's a real shark.
Yep. There you go. That little piece of info.
That's exciting.
Nugget.
Nugget of, like, that's kind of mean, though. It's like, so the villain of our film is going to be a guy that we work with.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of says something.
There was a little bit of hostility on the set, though.
Yeah. So
the crew started calling it production flaws.
Right.
Oh.
After a while. And then Spielberg, because he was so upset about the shark, called the special effects team the special defects team.
There's so much passive aggression on this set.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, you had to work with these people for 150 days and everything sucks. Yeah.
Like, holy crap.
Wow.
Yeah. And you are in Martha's Vineyard, which is nice, and you see everyone having a good time, and then you're like, fuck, I gotta drive the shark.
Hold on. I gotta get down here and drive this stupid shark.
Beep.
It was also very dangerous for the crew. Gottlieb, as we mentioned, the writer, almost got decapitated at one point. And Dreyfus almost got locked in that shark cage at another point. So there was a few times that it was like safety was a huge issue. Yikes. So that obviously changes, like, you know, the landscape in terms of like the attitudes, but also like how unprepared they were, even though they were like as prepared as it gets. It's just a very, very hard thing to do.
Right. Yeah, it's just sense. And we, I mean, it's to this day, like, you know, Waterworld and Titanic were both notoriously troubled productions because they're all in water.
Yep.
One obviously vastly more successful than the other.
Yeah.
But it's just a
water world,
right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, yeah. the timeless classic that we all that's all still on the tip of everyone's tongue.
Right.
Water world.
But I remember the first time me and my family got together and watched him drink his own piss. It just was like
it's super memorable.
It sticks with you. Yeah. It sticks with you. That's the kind of, you know, you define your life before that moment and after that moment.
Those are the memories that, you know.
Well, but it's crazy to think about how it's different now that we have CG. And, like, you think about how they made Titanic.
Yeah.
They just made it in, like, big aquariums. Like, everything is much more safe. Everything. So this is, like, film. This is, like, the old west of, like, water filming. And think before it. Like, other than, like, some Navy films, there wasn't a lot of call for films that were taking place on
entirely in the
water.
And normally they'd be shot in tanks on bat lots.
Yeah,
but I think
not exposed
to the ocean.
He
specifically wanted to avoid that look because you can always tell when it's a water tank.
Yeah, you can. Obvious, and if you want those sweeping shots, like that's incredibly transparent for audiences. Like they just go, oh wow, you know. But like for the filmmaker to be arrogant enough to say, like, let's do this in the wild.
Yeah.
Where there's actual sharks, you know, that's a big call.
What do you suppose the actual sharks thought when they saw that robot monstrosity?
Get the fuck out!
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. Hollywood came to town. Get out of here.
This taking all the good jobs. That job should have gone to a shark.
Oh, yeah, a pocket car and a standby. Come on.
And a standby.
They're all New England sharks.
Yeah, of course they are.
Kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shark taking our jobs.
Let's go to Baston.
You like the socks? Can't wear them. Love to watch them.
Let's get some Dunkin' Donuts.
Dunkies. Let's take a break to celebrate something here at Earwolf. Comedy Bang Bang, the very first Earwolf podcast hosted by Earwolf co-founder Scott Aukerman, just put out their 500th episode. If you don't know Comedy Bang Bang, it's a show where comedians and celebrities like John Hamm or Jane Lynch meet absurd characters like a robot named Lil Button Puss, the Cake Boss, or a duck. Scott put together an extra special episode for the 500th with some of the all-time greatest CBB guests. I think you're going to love it. We're talking about people like Paul F. Tompkins, Lauren Lapkus, Nick Kroll, and Jason Manzoukas. And with the show's famous open-door policy, you never know who's going to walk in. So celebrate by listening to Comedy Bang Bang's 500th episode in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher.
So now you know how hard that production was. I wanted to take a few moments to talk about post-production, specifically marketing. Hollywood, at this point, was in a five-year recession.
Hmm.
So they're hedging their bets. They were not looking to fund a big-budget film, as we said. And Jaws went on to become known as the first blockbuster, which set the stage for how Hollywood studios just took chances on films for the next, like, forever.
It started the
idea that there's a summer, like,
summer
release,
blockbuster
a big
season.
One, because it did so well and was so, like, impressive.
That term didn't even exist,
It did not exist until later.
Blockbuster didn't exist until after Jaws. Like, the big movies at the time that they were making, the big Hollywood successes, were all the Irwin Allen disaster movies, like Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno.
Yeah.
Earthquake was the one that Universal had just done the year before.
Gotcha.
So, like, those were the big moneymakers. Like, oh, but we'll do this cute shark movie for $9 million, but then we're going to have our Towering Inferno Part 2, and then that's going to put butts in seats.
Yeah. The other thing that they did for the marketing is, and this was straight out of Spielberg's brain, you know how we have 30-second teasers for...
Yeah.
That didn't really happen until this film.
Oh, interesting.
It invented the 30-second teaser. It was used on Jaws and became like the industry standard within years.
I'm assuming that they were all just like the POV shots from the water. Like,
yeah, it's the Chrissy... The woman who dies at the beginning, I think it was that 30 seconds where she's just dropped out and you're like, oh, but. Then within 2 years, I believe Star Wars came out. So that point, it was just like, okay, we're out of our recession.
This is how we make movies now. Yeah.
Yep. This is what we do.
Like, Jaws had an interesting thing because it was in the news so much before the marketing train actually started because it was such a troubled production. So it was like, you know how, like, we all heard about, like, how much trouble Waterworld was having, how much trouble Titanic was having. It was just one of those stories that they latched on to. It's like, oh, it's this new young director and this Universal sinking so much money into this troubled production.
Interesting.
So it was like a big news story for like a while. And then people started seeing the movie and the buzz started getting good. So they started doing marketing early. And that's kind of like also a template that movies still do now, where they start their marketing trains really early.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so once it was released, the movie came out, one of my favorite facts about Jaws is that it actually altered human psychology about sharks.
Really?
Shark killings went up after 1975. Whoa. And beach populations, especially during summer months, went down within like a year or so.
Really?
I agree with that. I don't. Why go to the ocean? We have pools. Like, we figured this out. Like, why would I willingly go into a shark's house?
Right.
Like, no, I'll swim in the pool.
Who's
0%
house? Shark's house.
But it's just funny to me that Spielberg literally scared the shit out of, like, families for, like, and their gatherings.
Right.
For,
he caused, like, an environmental crisis in this movie.
I remember a story when I was a kid is that we had a pool.
Yeah.
We were lucky.
That was the story you had as a kid?
That's my story. I'm
they
a pool guy.
Had a pool.
After I watched that film, I got super scared to go into the water.
Even in the pool, too.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Even though I could see everything. It's kid logic. It's just like, I'm swimming and I don't see what's behind me. And I know that when you're swimming, Jaws is there.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad thought he was helping. He thought, because I was like, I can't go in there. Jaws might be in there. And my dad said, oh, don't worry about it, Abe. Like, Jaws is way too big to fit in that pool. And I think his logic was like, this will solve the kid, because now the kid will know that Jaws will never be in there. Not me. I was like, somehow Jaws is going to be more terrifying and still in this pool.
Oh, no.
So it definitely was a thing.
Now the entire pool is Jaws.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just walking into his mouth.
That's my headspace now. I had this specific vision where I was convinced the bottom of the pool would open up and there he'd be.
Yeah, exactly.
It would just be like an abyss below him and he'd come up like, you thought you got away.
Yeah. I made this.
You're not safe anywhere.
Jaws is just like in the toilet, just waiting. Just
anywhere.
I've just been here the whole time.
Yeah, just tiny little Jaws's.
Yeah.
It's like fucking Pennywise. You crawl out any drain.
For sure.
Yeah. But I was from New England, so you thought you got away from me, but here I am.
Yeah.
Here I am.
I'm going to bite you.
I'm fucking Jaws.
I'm fucking Jaws.
Look at these apples, but it's a shark.
I love this New England shark parade that we're doing now. getting back to the release, it was the biggest release before Jaws of like recent note in the box office and recent memory for 1975 audiences was 2001 Space Odyssey. So think about that. Like, that's the movie that everyone's like going, you can go like, let's
that was
go to
like
that
the
one.
Biggest hit of the previous
yeah.
year.
Yeah. Wow. And it's like a philosophical, like, avant-garde film.
Yeah.
So
it's a movie that's impossible to decode too. It's like, what the, and that was like the biggest movie of the previous year. I also wanted to point out, like, the blockbuster landscape at this point. Like, these were the biggest movies of all time. You had The Exorcist, The Sting, Love Story, Gone with the Wind, Sound of Music, and The Godfather. So before Jaws was released, those were the biggest movies of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
it's incredibly different from what it is now. I mean, these are all dramas. Like, half of them are rated R.
Yeah, yeah.
One's a horror movie. It's like a totally different landscape for like what the big moneymaker movies would be.
So, and in that way, I don't think Hollywood, like, why would they take a chance on this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They need, in order for blockbusters to occur, it needed someone like Spielberg, who was like really good with finding ways to make huge motion pictures on a smaller budget. Like, that was his thing.
Yeah, the blockbuster formula just didn't exist.
Right.
And he basically invented it with this movie.
Right. I just want to take a moment and read, it's on the Wikipedia page, a funny review, or it's like, at the time, it reveals the landscape, kind of like what Tom's saying. According to New York Times, Pauline Kael, I think I want to say, it was, quote, the most cheerfully perverse scare movie ever made, with more zest than an early Woody Allen picture, a lot more electricity, and it's funny, in a Woody Allen sort of way. Which is so awesome.
Right.
Because it's like, these critics have never seen anything like it.
Right. It's like, it's like so alien to them that they reference Woody Allen twice in one sentence in a Jaws review.
In a Jaws review. And it's also saying, like, they clearly don't understand Woody Allen that much either. Yeah. Like,
well, they just,
he's
one.
He's big, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
one,
I mean,
notorious predator and then another notorious predator.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a common ground.
Why don't you guys know that scene in the movie where the shark is just like, oh, I know, the female sharks, I don't like me.
I can't.
It's why I
eat
the women.
I don't know if I should eat this person or just go and not eat them.
Oh, I love the taste of a child.
In a very
three
way.
Very different Woody Allen.
It's like the chicken dance and Arrested Development.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Oh.
Was that the beginning of your Woody Allen?
Yes, it was.
I was laughing. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Woody, I ruined it. All right, let's get back on the boat. Spielberg was also known as like a staunch negotiator.
Even at this point in his career?
Well, this is like kind of the start of it. Well, at least on this film, it worked his way. He argued his way with the studio, and he got like Final Cut points merchandise.
Wow.
He got all those rights at an unparalleled extent at this point in cinematic history. In fact, George Lucas learned this from Spielberg through this film. Oh. They were talking. He's like, this is what I did, Georgie. And Stevie's like, dude.
Stevie and Georgie.
Yeah, Stevie and Georgie.
And George's like, that's a good idea.
And hence Lucas's.
I'm going to make lots of toys.
Yeah. So Lucas overwhelmingly owned Star Wars.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why he became so rich. So it's just another marriage of like, no other directors were that marriage of studio and auteur at this point. Mm. The studio really hadn't played that out. And so they didn't know what they weren't going to get.
Yeah, yeah.
So all the studio directors at the point just got, at this point just got paid and credit and goodbye.
All right, now that we've talked about how the movie was made, we're going to get into some kind of observations
What do we call that segment?
We call this segment Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
This is kind of like symbolism, kind of like subtext you might not have noticed.
Yeah, what's the movie secretly about? Yeah. That kind of stuff.
All right.
We're looking for individual like images or just like, you know, looking at it in scope. Anything. Just like
some
any
honors English shit, right?
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
This is my favorite.
Some art history bullshit.
Okay. Oh, I got some good stuff.
Right. Bring that shit in.
I got some good stuff. I'm gonna start us right off with some David Lean. The film that Steven Spielberg has said that he watches before he makes any film, every time, is Lawrence of Arabia, made by David Lean, 1962.
you're like, it's just really funny that he's just like, I watch this movie before I watch anything else.
It's true, but it's really good.
Yeah. Oh, like, no, it's a great movie. That's just a hilarious fact.
It's a dickhead thing to say.
Yeah.
Oh, totally.
I eat a waffle I watch Lawrence of Arabia.
I scramble one egg.
Yeah, exactly.
I eat it very slowly, and I watch Lawrence of Arabia.
Nice wide shot, David.
He speaks to him like he's there.
Yeah,
exactly. He speaks to David Lean while he's watching the movie.
I also like that our Spielbergs are like kind of David Lynch. You know,
I'm gonna scramble one egg.
Yeah, quinoa. all right. So let me tell you why this is important because this is like the film where remember how I was talking about at the beginning? Every film is kind of a love song.
Yeah.
To a previous film. I think I'm arguing that this is his to Lawrence of Arabia, and there's one reason why, which is if you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, spoilers if you haven't, but it's a very old movie, so I don't really give a shit.
That was the spoiler, but it's a very old movie.
Peter O'Toole, who plays T. Lawrence, dies at the end, and he's like a great man who did a lot of cool things, but the death scene is the way that he shows it is he's driving down really fast down a road, and some bicyclists are there, and he like swerves so he won't hit him, and he like hits a ravine and falls into like you just see a car you see the motorcycle quickly hit a bush, and you never see his body. But then David Lean does something that like no one has really ever done or I hadn't seen at this point in cinematic history, which is to show a death by like it's just a shot of a trees with like the sun behind it. Mm. And then it's just the goggles that he was wearing for the motorcycle just quietly drifting for like 6 seconds. It's an eternity. And it's like that's exactly what Spielberg does in the first segment is it's violence for 45 seconds and then she just gets dropped and we just hear this. And you hear the little buoy.
Yeah.
And it's just like that. And then it cuts to the boyfriend who's on like the beach. Yeah. And it's just the little gentle lapping on his feet. Mm-hmm. And it's just like super cool.
And then it's a very wide shot of just the buoy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It all ends very like it's the hardcore, like really like it's an intense death scene. And then when she gets pulled under, everything stops. The music stops.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then it's just the buoy.
And I think lifted that straight out of Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah, he's basically just going like violence of death, and then just nothing.
And he does it again with the little boy.
Yeah,
because at the end of the panic, there's the raft on the
on the
beach,
in the water.
Just in the water
it's super effective though,
it's
right?
Real
cause,
effective.
Because you're going like, oh, everything's super violent, and then it's gone, and you're like, where did that violence go?
Yeah,
like it's now beneath the waves.
And then the attack with the dock, the jetty. Mm-hmm. It's like the jetty slowly comes up and crashes into the shore,
and then it
just
holds. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, yeah, you're right. It's all over this movie.
Yep, and that's his love song. That's my theory. It's his love song to David Lean. Do you got anything for this segment?
Man, I don't think so.
I could talk more. I could do the Marxist argument.
Well, I don't know.
Do you want me to go for that?
Brandon, did you notice anything?
I want to hear this Marxist argument. I mean, everyone's just everyone's dad. Every time there's a bunch of guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
And that's so true.
Spielberg does make a lot of dad movies.
Yeah, they're all just dad squad. They're all calling each other dad. Dad, how are you doing, dad? I don't know, dad. Don't call me son.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want to play catch?
No. No. I don't have time.
Don't have time, son.
We'll get together then.
No podcast complete without a cat's cradle reference. I'll talk about that then.
Yeah. So
something else I noticed, and I was reading a paper about it, is what this like could be secretly about. It's a little far-fetched, but it's kind of cool when you think about it. And it falls into a bunch of other things that make a lot of sense with Spielberg's like MO as a filmmaker. So there's this Marxist argument. So where America's at right now, it's July 4th.
Yeah.
Nuclear families are gathering at a beach. Mm-hmm. Brody's trying to close the beach. That's like the setup of the film, right?
Yeah.
Now look at the three main characters. So if, for example, take Quint, who's the archaic symbol of like this battered down New Deal America. They went through World War II.
He's the greatest generation.
He's the greatest generation. He's a drunk. He's shaken by history.
Yeah.
Brody and Hooper are younger.
Yeah.
And
Hooper's specifically young. Like they make that very clear. Like he's. Mm-hmm.
And in order for this theory to work, I want you to think of them as like an alliance of like the new guard, like the new people are going to inherit the earth, right? Okay. And so on one hand, you have Brody, who's like the new form of law and order. He's a cop. And the new technocracy, which is basically, you know, Dreyfus.
Yeah. Hooper and all his gadgets.
Yeah, all his gadgets. He's constantly being made fun of by Quint.
Boat. Yeah, yeah. And Quint just shits on him. He's like, what's that?
This is like, toothbrush. So they're very much product of the 60s, 70s, where it was we fought a war and now you're a great hope. Now you're 20-somethings. So the Everman Brody, who's our main character, is stuck between like the traditional Quint and the future promise of Hooper.
Yeah.
This is something that is singular to Jaws, isn't singular for Jaws, to Jaws for Spielberg. He loves talking about how the everyman struggle between like determining the righteous path of traditionalism and modernity.
Yeah.
But it's like you have this old version of how things worked and you have this new like technocracy and like corporate kind of standpoint. And he's in between the two, which is great.
Oh, right, because Hooper's rich, too.
He's rich,
and Quint specifically resents him for that too.
Yeah. So both Quint and Hooper's paths to kill Jaws do not work, right? But the marriage of the two, Harpoon, an oxygen tank.
Oh, right, yeah. So you get Quint tries everything. They go through everything he's got. He's got his barrel system where they're shooting the shark with it. His gun doesn't work. His boat is sinking. The barrels don't work. The gun doesn't work. His boat is destroyed and it's sinking. And that's when he finally turns to Hooper and says, Hooper, what can your stuff do?
Yeah.
And then Hooper tries his stuff and that doesn't work. Like his cage, his fancy thing. It just immediately gets
not
a dumb idea. Also, his like little dinky cage. Like he was getting in. I was like, I know you survived this, but you shouldn't have.
Right. He doesn't in the book.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, cool.
And he was kind of a sleazier character in the book. It was good that they cut all that stuff out.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is pretty typical for Spielberg and like Spielberg movies.
And so the everyman wins by
kind of marrying the heads of state.
Yeah. He shoves Hooper's air tank.
The power of the people. That's a great term for it because Spielberg talks about all the time when he was a child. In his childhood, he never felt like he belonged.
Mm.
I mean, he was a Jew in a suburb in a WASP culture. He was not a hippie during the 60s. He's straight edge, if you don't know.
Oh, fuck yeah, so am I.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Hell yeah, Spielberg.
Yo, Stevie!
See you at a Minor Threat show, bro.
What if you did?
That'd be amazing.
He's just there wearing his NASA hat.
Yeah. Oh, I just watched Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, boy. It ain't a waffle. You want a waffle?
Spielberg is Mickey Mouse in this routine.
Oh yeah, all the time. I am very bad at impressions. I just go all over the place. He never felt like a studio director, and he was never truly an auteur because he always kind of worked in a studio.
And
he was in total admirations of the classics, but he definitely wanted to do something new. So you see this constant theme of like taking old and the recent technology and marrying it. I mean, that's his MO.
Yeah.
Jaws is all the problems his career will face. And Spielberg is, and obviously the writers and producers of the film, his diagnosis is to Joan both at the hip and improvise wildly.
And in terms of the Marxist theory, the movie itself is sort of an indictment of capitalism, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. The July 4th stuff is a big thing.
The reason
the
beach is open is because all the businesses are like, well, we got to make money. So they're putting people's lives at risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the shark itself is just they make a point of mentioning that all it does is eat. It's just something that endlessly consumes.
Yeah,
it can't sleep. It just moves and moves and,
and eats.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's a pretty...
There goes Carl.
No.
Good old Karl Marx over here.
Yeah.
Makes
Killing
sense to
it.
Me.
Yeah. No, Killing it's it, a, yeah. And just, it, I mean, that beach represents America, basically, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved it when the shark was hanging out with Allen Ginsberg.
And, yeah.
And they're just like, snapping
doing some beat poetry.
Why can't I snap my fins? Oh, I'm going to go eat somebody.
He's kind of clapping.
Now the shark is Mickey Mouse to me. Yeah. I can't use my fin.
I'm so impressed.
And Bruce, by the way.
Yeah. You want to talk about bonus scenes?
Oh, yeah.
I'll transition it for you.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to segue to a segment that talks about scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot.
Oh.
In a segment we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed.
Yeah, just... Anything you would have liked to have seen.
Yeah.
Oh, in the movie.
Yeah. Okay. Any extra scenes you'd like to see. I'll get us started if you don't have anything right off the bat.
Yeah, me think.
What you think about it.
All right,
I've got a couple. One.
Yeah.
I really want to see Brody come back and ask Mrs. Kittner for that money.
Which one's
Mrs. Kittner's the boy's mom who puts up the $1,000 bounty.
The most acted scene of all time.
Yeah.
When she's just like shaking with tears. Ooh. Just like, I'm like, you killed my wife. Just shaking with rage.
Also, who is that 10,000-year-old man that's with her?
No.
That's not her husband, right? That's not the kid's father.
People age poorly in this town.
I think it was probably just like a whole family that Jaws had taken like piece by piece. You know? So grandma went first.
Yeah. And then
I want to see Brody like drive over to her house and be like, yeah, I killed the shark.
Yeah.
I think you owe me a little something.
Yeah.
A stack of paper.
Stack of paper, baby.
Stack of papes.
Yeah, I'm benefiting from your loss.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you hand over that money?
I'll remember him fondly with every dollar I spend, but I'm going to need that money. I also want to see that one guy who's right before the shark attacks the little boys. You know, he's playing fetch with his dog in the water, and all of a sudden the dog's gone.
Yeah.
He's like, Pipette, come here. And then you just see, like, the stick floating in the water. I want to see a scene where that guy's just going around Amity posting up lost dog signs.
Yeah.
Like, sadly stapling. Like, just at the bottom of it, he's like, lost dog, all the information. Yeah. And at the bottom, he's like, this has no relevance. I just want to let you know I'm all... I'm very sad.
He was my son. Yeah. He was my first son.
He was my child.
My dog's son.
Really, I should slap Brody as well.
Dog's
son. Exactly.
He offers a reward at the bottom.
Yeah.
The shark calls.
I was so mad at the one boat that had two dogs just on it going out to kill the shark.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, why are you taking those dogs?
Well, like, what are they going to do?
What are you doing with these dogs?
Like, were they going to retrieve it?
Like,
are they going to bark at it?
Oh, yeah. Man.
Oh, they're definitely
going
to bark at it.
Yeah. Because they're like, I have never been on the sea.
Yeah.
And what the fuck is that?
Yeah. Well, is that like a big dog? No.
Nah.
That's
Bruce. Oh, boy, dogs.
It's one of my favorite dudes in the whole movie is in that group of people. Remember when they catch the fake shark and they string him up?
Mm.
And like, what kind of shark is it? And Hoover's like, it's a tiger shark. And that guy turns the camera. He's like, oh, what?
Yeah. That was probably a local actor, an extra. Oh, they were like, who's got a surprise face? Okay, you do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they had to choose from locals, right?
Right.
They had some sweet townies in this movie.
There are
some seamen in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
Some salty dogs.
Salty dogs.
That guy, his name's Ben Gardner in the movie. The guy, when Hoover finds a boat and the guy's eye's missing.
Oh, yeah.
That guy's a townie. And he is, you can tell, because he is like the crustiest old salt.
Like, I want to know that casting director who's in charge of like finding extras and townspeople. Do they just like go to bars and like single clubs and stuff like that?
Probably.
And just like,
that's where I would
who's
go.
The saddest?
Yeah. Where's the town silent bar?
where it was just sitting there.
Yeah.
Just stewing over a tin cup of liquor.
Just go to the hotel. Where will I meet the most murderers? just go to the pier.
You go to the quiet bar. Yeah. Nobody speaks.
There's a corner of the pier.
There's a jukebox. It hasn't been turned on in 7 years.
I just thought of the guy from Bar Rescue trying to redo a silent bar. So no, we gotta set some stuff on fire. Let's get a couple of cool liquor things there. And they're just like, I don't much like
flame decals.
Yeah. Put a karaoke system in the corner. We'll get some hot bartenders. Come on, we'll have some mixed drinks that cost $15. You guys be into that, right? That's what we do. And that guy looks like a shark.
Yeah.
You ever seen him? What's his name? John something? He's got that weird T-Rex neck. It's just so thick. He's got a thick neck. He just looks like he's ripping flesh with every bite.
Yeah.
It's so thick and his hair is so small.
Like, how does air get out of it?
Yeah.
Like, it feels like it's just muscle and fat.
He's got a fish face. He's got a real fish face.
Goddamn shark. Yeah. I like to think that he comes in and redresses he does Bar Rescue, and it's just the same. Like, they're all still sitting in there quietly, but it's just like this amusement park around them.
Just paint some glitter on that old captain. It's fine.
Glitter on the captain.
Yeah.
It's just shoots him.
So what about, you got any extra scenes you'd like to see?
Something you wish?
I would have liked to have seen the mayor get his comeuppance a little bit. I don't know exactly what that scene is, but I would have liked some sort of FU for that guy. Because he was so irresponsible.
Absolutely.
You know, that you're like, you should have lost something.
Yeah, like a foot.
Yeah, like he should. Yeah, like something should have happened to him.
I think the implication is that he's going to lose his mayordom.
Yeah.
Because everyone's going to be like, you knew this was happening. Because, obviously Brody's going to be like, this guy did that.
You hope so.
And I saved the town.
And
so they're all going to be like, well, you're our mayor now.
Yeah.
you're our chieftain.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so.
Man.
Mr. President.
Yeah. I wish Quint had gotten I wish he'd gotten punch the shark or something before he ate him.
Yeah.
His death really made me sad because I kind of was, it was like, oh man, you feared sharks and you have this horrible PTSD and then you're going out in this horrible way. I wish you'd gotten one last moment of triumph in there before you died.
Yeah.
That's the one thing. I wish there was some moment of we thought we had it and then it was gone. And then that's when we think all hope is gone.
I kind of disagree, to be honest with you. Well, here's the thing is that's the whole point of him is that he's that old generation that's already lived.
Yeah.
And he's just a ghost in this town.
Yeah.
He's just this, he's got to just disappear slowly off the face of the earth. So I kind of love how the death itself is kind of way too.
Yeah.
He disappears pretty rapidly.
He does.
but I mean, it's like it starts and then he gets pulled. Like the whole sequence.
That's another David Lean thing.
Yeah.
Once Quint's dead and he spits the blood out of his mouth, it's very quiet and he kind of rolls over flat as the shark pulls him down into the water and it's quiet.
It's he's already dead.
It's all over that.
It's all over, man.
He does. It's. I mean, you blink and you miss it. He is stabbing the shark in the face.
That is true.
But it's very ineffectual. He should have gotten a fuck you.
Yeah,
you
know, I wish he'd gotten one of his eyes or something.
Yeah,
and there's from that monologue on, because he was funny before the monologue, and then from that point till when he's death, you're like, oh, this is a haunted man.
That's when you understand him.
So to have him die like that really was man. Nothing's
fair. Terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really terrible. This is the thing that's haunted him every night. And he's why he never had a relationship or anything.
Yeah.
And then it actually just happened to him too.
Right.
Well, he turned to the booze. You know, it's all that stuff.
Why the fuck were they drinking?
You do on a boat.
Pirate rules,
man.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, but also there's a monster shark that's killing people.
Right.
Shouldn't you want your
drink
senses?
When you get back?
Yeah, exactly. Have a celebratory booze.
I mean,
he's
getting 2 cases of apricot brandy. We know this.
Yes.
Because he asks for it.
That's what he asks for.
Yeah, it's one of the things he asks for.
Apricot brandy.
Apricot.
Would that taste good?
I don't know. I think he was asking for something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know. Who's an alcoholic?
Get me
brandy.
2 cases of Schlitz.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I wish? I wish Brody's wife had punched the mayor in the face. I think that I wish
that would have been good at the hospital.
Yeah, I wish wish there had been a moment of action from a woman.
Yep.
It was the one thing that I really would have liked
in
the movie. Because there weren't any she was the biggest female character, I think. And
she was, but she's not much.
Yeah, but she does a lot with what she has, but I think I really would have liked that, I think, would have been That would have been fun.
That would have been awesome.
One moment. You get a little bit from Miss Kittner because she comes up and slaps Brody. And like, that like brings it home. He's like, oh shit, I've really sold out here.
Yeah.
I should have stood my ground harder.
I killed a kid.
Yeah, for sure.
But you do want more things to happen. It's implied, but like, yeah. There's a visceral experience in like, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
The mayor, this is all your fault.
Yeah. He's really like, at least a foot. Lose a foot.
Yeah, for sure.
1 foot.
The mob scene after where everyone, after they fire off the fireworks, they go and grab the mayor and they just throw him into Jaws' mouth.
Yeah. I was going to say, it doesn't even need to be the shark. Just chop his foot off. Brody just hatches his leg.
All right, well, let's get the position.
You kind of owe this. So,
You're going to lose at least a finger. A finger for every body we lost.
You're mayor footless now.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've watched the movie. Mm-hmm. Now, we've taken some observations you may have heard. Basically, any non-intuitive arguments we have about these things, that's what this segment is for.
Segment we like to call Let's Overthink It.
Oh.
Tom, now that we've watched the movie, we're going to overthink it.
Yeah, because that's what we do here.
Jaws is Jesus, right? I don't know. Yeah. Is that what we do?
He just leaps up on the shrimp. I'm Christ!
Yeah. I'm sacrificed for your sins. Yeah.
Flops into the ocean.
I could have bullshitted a paper in college for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sure.
That's some king level BS.
Yeah,
for sure.
So I had one, and this is actually, it's from one of the... I think the first video I ever did for Cracked was about this, and it's a pet theory of mine. Okay. I think the movie is an allegory for Brody's alcoholism.
As
we've noted a few times, alcohol is a pervasive presence in this movie.
Yeah.
And we notice that that's how Brody responds to stress.
Yeah.
Like he gets super, like he drinks a bottle of wine at home and then goes out on the ocean with Hooper and drinks a second bottle of wine by himself after the Kittner thing when Miss Kittner slaps him. They get trashed on the sea with Quint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about him like not being able to be responsible, which is like what happens when you get super drunk. Like he lets himself become ineffectual and then people get hurt.
Yeah.
And so we know he's a cop that came from New York. And in the scar comparing scene, he has a scar, but then he like hides it.
Doesn't tell anybody.
So it's an embarrassing scar. Mm-hmm. So I think he got that scar like in a DUI. He like crashes police cruiser
and
in New York.
And he's super insecure about it.
Yeah. And they're like, okay, you can't be a cop in New York. And we're going to ship you off to a small town nowhere where you're going to be a cop that everybody pushes around.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's just like there's a lot of like symbolism in there. Like when Hooper's like describing the missing tooth to Mayor Vaughn, he says it's the size of a shot glass.
Mm. I thought that was like very pointedly. Really cool point. Yeah. Like I didn't put that together until you pointed that out.
They hunt the shark by shooting it with beer kegs.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Empty kegs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find that fascinating because, as we mentioned, Spielberg is straight edge. So he doesn't really unless maybe in early life and he just hasn't talked about it. He hasn't had like a
direct experience
with addiction in that way. Maybe has had addiction with other things and that's why he's straight edge. But I think he's always been straight edge as far as that's the tale. So it's interesting that he would tackle fairly early. I think your theory is right. I'm not saying that you're wrong.
Yeah. I'm not saying.
It's so much lined up against it. It's a great argument.
I think the shark is definitely... I'm not arguing that shark doesn't exist, but I mean, because it clearly does. But
it's
like the shark represents his alcoholism, and then the shark attacks the boat and does the damage that ends up being catastrophic. It ruins the engine while they're all getting fucked up. And then they defeat the shark, and then they swim back to safety on the empty beer kegs.
Yeah,
so he's like, I'm giving up drinking.
And then that one scene where he like comes out of the water, you can see if you look closely, like a little Miller Lite logo on the shark. Like he's clearly gotten a tattoo.
Yeah,
the dog that died was Spuds McKenzie.
Yeah,
partying no more.
Yeah.
So we talked about how the movie's made and all the different things.
Unless anybody else had a thing for overthinking it.
Oh gosh.
Don't mean to put you on the spot.
How far can I bullshit this?
Give it a shot. I am open.
Yeah.
Probably some Vietnam shit in here, right?
Yeah, World War II at
least.
Almost
certainly, yeah. We have a war vet with PTSD.
Yeah, for sure.
How about just the idea of a horror movie as an allegory to it, meaning that Jaws is in control of his environment, so your enemy is one who can be anywhere.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. You know? You're trying to move into his environment.
Right.
And police him, and it's like, bro, you don't.
Yeah.
You have no jurisdiction here.
Yeah. What they should have done is gotten Dennis Rodman to come and talk to the shark. And be like, hey, man, why don't you just chill out? And then that's the movie.
It's North Korea.
I know. I know.
But... Still works. Dennis Rodman should come talk. They should have put Dennis Rodman in that shark cage.
Highly effective diplomat.
Yeah.
Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, you know.
Put Rodman in the shark cage.
Master of jams and talking.
Absolutely. Look, he's just mad he was never in Space Jam, so he's just like making up for it by solving world problems.
I mean, of his entire career, that's probably the biggest, you know, failure of his.
Huge slight.
Just not getting into Space Jam.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably furious.
You know?
Yeah.
That's the brass ring.
It's not the bulls.
Yeah. No.
He's got a few rings.
Yeah.
Certainly wasn't double team with Van Damme.
Yeah. No. That's airtight reference. I love it. Killing it with the references. Well, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. So we talked about how the movie was made, mm-hmm. some things that were problematic. Right now, we'd like to talk about just, it can be a yes or no answer, but we'd love to give your justification and it just knee jerk.
Okay.
For both of you. And I'll start. Should this be a movie that when we send that gold record again up to space, my big question is, do we show this movie to aliens?
Do we show this movie to aliens?
No.
No. Why?
No, because I don't want to show them any kind of weakness.
Oh, so they might want to keep us absolutely impenetrable.
Yeah.
They might see that and be like, they're weak to sharks. Let's make a whole bunch of sharks.
These idiot drunks, let's draw some giant sharks in the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a fair, valid point. Mm-hmm. I disagree. Okay. I think we should.
You do.
And the reason is I want them to fear our oceans.
I
think that you think taking over land might be bad. 70% of this shit is sharks.
What are you going to do against this thing?
Deal with it.
It's a tube with teeth.
Do you have harpoons and, you know, scuba gear?
No water in space.
No water in space. So that's my take.
Oh, man.
Do you got one?
Tiebreaker.
Yeah, really?
Man, I'm thinking no, because it shows the weakness of our infrastructure.
Yeah. Mm.
The failure of both our government and our law enforcement to protect us.
Yes, and they're at odds.
I think we're on this. Brandon and I are on the same page about this. Shows a huge weakness in humans.
Fair enough. Yeah. And no's have it.
And also our complete mistrust of aliens.
Oh, yeah. The one scene when the alien crashes in Jaws.
We love that question here, and we inspire our audience to answer the question for themselves and give reasons, because it always is different. Like every time our criterion for why it should or shouldn't be for aliens, not just like the reason itself, but like, no, I don't want to show it to them because it'll show their weakness, or they should fear us, or, you know, like they'll be happy to meet us, you know, like it just is all over the place. It's pretty funny.
Huh.
So, yeah.
It does have a good text in history though, with his Indianapolis thing. And
yeah.
It also shows like the long-term effects of our war and how we treat our veterans. And I don't know. There's arguments for or against. I'm sticking with my no, though.
Yeah, you better.
Sticking with my no.
I don't like this flip-flop.
I didn't think about it at all until we got to this segment. So.
You should do that.
I kind of like having the knee jerk. Well, so I'll do both. I'll surprise you each time.
All right. Well, do you have any
never
final thoughts?
What's going on with me?
You guys have any final thoughts about the movie before we begin our wrap-up?
Yeah, it's fun. Go watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody who just watched it for the first time.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. Brandy gives it thumbs up.
Yeah. Thumbs up. Sure.
I mean, it's my favorite movie.
Wow.
I've been watching it since I was 3 or 4.
How many times do you think you've seen it?
Yeah, easily over 100.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I've owned like 4 or 5 different copies of it on various formats. My parents got the VHS for me for my birthday when I was like 4. And nice. I would just, that was like my Nickelodeon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that was the thing. I would just park in front of it and just watch it all day. Like it ended, rewound it. Like that was my Frozen. Like
oh,
I would just
that's awesome.
Rewind it. And my parents were like, yeah, we we thought maybe something was wrong with you because, like, you know, at the time, this is like mid-80s, so Jaws is like not quite 10 years old.
Yeah.
And it's, so it's, it still has this reputation of being the scariest movie ever. And I'm just sitting there like as a little kid, like cross-legged, like I'm watching Saturday morning cartoons. Like,
they think he's possessed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Were you singing the theme just like with Frozen all the time?
Yeah.
Just like, put it on again. I love that song. Dan it.
Let it go.
Yeah.
Toe tapping. I knew that about you.
Hmm.
Brandy, do you have a favorite movie or a few movies?
Oh, man. Yeah. It's hard.
Haven't seen that one.
No. I don't have like one that is my favorite movie. I have one that is my most influential movie. I'll say it that way.
Okay,
what's that
one? Let's hear it.
Ace Ventura 2.
Oh!
When Nature Calls?
Yes.
When Nature Calls.
That is a great movie.
I saw it the year that it came out theaters, and the scene where he comes out of the rhino's butt was the moment that I wanted to become a comedian.
So
like,
funny.
I wanted to work in the world of comedy because of how funny that moment was. And to this day, I've not missed the opening day of a Jim Carrey movie.
Oh, man. I remember.
It is intensely funny, like, burned
in my brain by how much I laughed at the single moment when he comes out and it's got his bottom jaw.
And he's
just like, his eyes are like going back and he's just demonic looking.
Well, and then it's
rhino's ass.
When it cuts to the wide shot and it's so tiny and the gigantic rhino,
it's just shaky.
It's so funny.
It's a brilliant movie.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
It's a very
good
movie.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a
pretty big life changer for me.
So we're done here.
Yeah.
But we want to talk about how you can talk to us. So first off, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Pod.
And if you got, like we were saying, give us on any of those platforms, you can hit us with whether or not you would show this movie to aliens.
Yeah.
Also, if you got any terrible log lines you want to share with us.
Or ideas for new segments.
Or ideas for new segments, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Hit us up with your thoughts, people. We've been Abe, Tom, and Brandy. Brandy, where can we find you on the line?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Brandazzle is my Twitter and Instagram handle. I'm on Facebook. You can find my fan page if you look up Brandy Posey. And then Lady to Lady is my podcast. Picture This is a monthly show that I do here in Los Angeles that pairs up comedians with animators and they draw your jokes behind you live.
Yeah, it seems really cool.
It's
really
fun.
Cool.
We've had we get big animators. Like we just had the creator of Hey Arnold on the show.
Oh,
oh
shit.
Wow.
Like Pendleton Ward has done it from Adventure Time before.
Oh wow,
like,
that's great.
Our two head animators work on BoJack Horseman and Mr. Pickles.
Oh nice. Man.
It's really fun.
Yeah.
And then I have an album that came out last year called Opinion Cave.
Where can we find that?
You can find it on iTunes, Bandcamp. It's on Spotify. If you listen to it on Spotify or a streaming network, I highly would prefer you also like
to buy it.
Or put it on mute and play it 300 times.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Overnight. I would appreciate
that.
Yeah. I also, if you want a physical copy of it, maybe you do, they're on cassette, which are super cool. And they have digital download codes inside of them.
Cool.
And those are on my website at brandyposey.com.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
We're honored.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the next month, we're starting a new director, Christopher Nolan.
Oh.
Yeah, for the month of August.
Yeah.
It'll be Nolan August.
Nolan month.
Nice.
Nolist.
Nolan.
And our first movie is going to be
The Prestige.
Yes.
Ooh.
So look forward to that after this, next week.
Yeah, yeah.
And Comment Buddies, we're open to film and directors that you want us to talk about. Just let us know. I'm not joking. We'll read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll listen.
Let us know.
That's it. Watch on, movie people.
Thank you. Hey guys, thanks so much for listening to that episode. I got to take a minute here to tell you about some of our great sponsors. Phil is the smarter prescription refill service. So no more standing in line at the chain drugstore for your monthly medications, because with Phil, your monthly medications are filled by top-rated, locally owned pharmacies and then delivered to your door for free. They troubleshoot insurance and chase after doctors so you don't have to. Go to phil.us/club to get $20 off your first prescription. That's Phil, like the person, .us/club. Like Abe and I, comedian Doug Benson loves movies so much that he made a podcast about it. Now you can hear all 8 seasons of Doug Loves Movies on Stitcher Premium, plus hear bonus episodes and the Benson Interruption completely ad-free. That's over 1,000 hours of Doug Benson podcasts for just $4.99 a month or $34.99 a year. Start listening now with a 1-month free trial of Stitcher Premium. Go to stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your free month. That's stitcherpremium.com/Doug and use promo code CRACKED.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.